Taking aim.
Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Schoen. And we have a special program for you today, Tuesday, February 5th. And it's a WBAI fund drive. We are going to play excerpts from 9/11, Permanent War, and the Repressive Apparatus of the State. Is martial law on the agenda? How fitting for Super Tuesday here with the presidential elections, the nominating elections that are taking place today in many states across the country. This was a lecture that Ralph, Frank Morales, and I gave in Berkeley on Tuesday, October 30th, 2007. Frank Morales spoke on Police State America and Pentagon Civil Disturbance Planning. Ralph and I both addressed 9/11 and the architecture of the fascist state. This is a three CD, audio CD, gift to you for your contribution to WBAI. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Your contribution of $100. I know you're going to want to have this incredible three CD program. We are going to play the three excerpts from each of our speech, the beginning parts of our speech, and then we're going to have a discussion for the second half of this program. I want to mention that we're going to be on each Tuesday on our regular Taking Aim slot during the fund drive, and the last week we'll be on for an extended evening program, too. So right away, let's go to 9/11, Permanent War, and the Repressive Apparatus of the State. Is martial law on the agenda? Michael?
Ralph and Maya?
Yes, Michael.
Okay. Are we ready to go?
Yes, we are.
All right. Thank you so much. Let's give that number out once more for people.
212-209-2950. And if the lines are busy, hold on. Try again.
Okay.
212-209-2950.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much. Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, the program Taking Aim, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., part of WBAI's winter fundraising drive. And let's begin, shall we?
Tonight, I'm going to talk about the repressive apparatus of the state, the context of it, what it is about 9/11 that leads us to the repressive apparatus of the state. I went back to a program that we did 1 year after 9/11. The first anniversary is we had a show called 9/11 False Flag Operation, and it began like this. In the immediate aftermath of the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, authorities already were sounding the alarm that a terrorist network was involved, and they specified Osama bin Laden, an Islamic fundamentalist in the Al-Qaeda network. The authorities did not disclose, however, that this very network had been established by the Central Intelligence Agency and that Osama bin Laden and his associate, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, had received $6 billion from U.S. intelligence agencies, specifically to create a terrorist network not merely in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan and beyond, in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and the surrounding area. The authorities were quick to point the finger at a demonic figure. But if we look carefully at the press at the time and in the years since, we find that, in fact, the U.S. government, its intelligence agencies, and its spokespersons were not telling the truth. 9/11 is a false flag operation. And that is an intelligence term that signifies that the blame has been placed elsewhere to conceal U.S. government authorship. Right away, right after 9/11, in October, less than 2 weeks later, you had on ABC This Week Air Force General Richard Myers, who at the time was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And this is when they were considering that they were going to attack Afghanistan. They were going to take out this terrorist network of Osama bin Laden. But there was a headline in the newspaper right after ABC This Week, and it said, quote, a top U.S. officer said Sunday, Afghanistan is only a small piece of the U.S. campaign that could last more than a lifetime. Now, Air Force General Richard Myers stated at the time that the Pentagon, quote, had started to prepare targets in Iraq. This is a global war on terrorism and weapons of mass destruction, he said, and Afghanistan is only one small piece. Of course, we're thinking very broadly. Since World War II, we haven't thought this broadly about a campaign. General Myers at the time was asked about a comment by Vice President Dick Cheney, who had said that the campaign, this long war on terror, quote, may never end, at least not in our lifetime, end quote. This is right after the events of 9/11. Now, that comment by Dick Cheney had been cited by the Washington Post and was published on October 23rd, a month and a half. I think this is correct, Meyer said. This is going to be a long, hard-fought conflict, and it will be global in scale, and it won't be just military. It's going to be all the instruments of our national power. Look at what they were telling us in the moment. In the moment, they were saying this was a global war. It was going to go on throughout our lifetime and maybe beyond, but more of that, more, that it was going to involve all the instruments of national power. And that doesn't just mean international extension of the hegemony of capitalism. It means using the instruments of national power against the people of the United States. First and foremost, you have to fund this vast military apparatus. $500 billion, 50% of the discretionary budget for basic military spending. More than $10 billion a month now is diverted for the occupation of Iraq and the ongoing attack against Afghanistan. $10 billion accumulates $500 billion to be spent so far on this military adventure. Think about what that means when you say more than 50% of discretionary funding. The non-discretionary funding is Social Security, which they have been raiding. It is the Medicare-specific taxes, the money that should go for health services, the money that should go for education, the money that goes for schools. All that is diverted. When that is diverted, people will resist. And that is why they talk about the instruments of national power. These are long-standing plans, and I recommend that you read Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, because in it, Ralph is meticulous about describing the long-standing plans for the occupation of Iraq. Referring to Robert Tucker, 1975, seizing Arab oil fields by direct military intervention, where Tucker describes the Arab shoreline of the Gulf, a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador. That is the Middle East and their long-standing plans. We saw in the London Times where the defense editor, Michael Evans, on September 20th, 2001, wrote, quote, secret plans for a 10-year war. Well, he was being optimistic. Dick Cheney and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, 10 years wasn't enough for them. And he said this 10-year war was called Operation Noble Eagle. It was a combined plan of the U.S. and Great Britain. The BBC, September 18, 2001, said, quote, the U.S. planned the attack on the Taliban and military action against Osama bin Laden in July, long before the events of 9/11. But they couldn't pull it through, as we know now, unless they had a false flag, unless they could get the people of the United States riled up and saying, we must go on the attack. Why Afghanistan? Why Central Asia? The Oil and Gas Journal in the 1990s stated, quote, by 2050, Central Asia will account for more than 80% of U.S. oil. We think of the Middle East when we think of oil outside the confines of territorial United States, but we don't think of Central Asia. But the Oil and Gas Journal understood the importance. It said Central Asia represents the world's last great frontier for geological survey and analysis, offering opportunities for investment, production, transportation, and refining of trillions of dollars of oil and gas services. But Central Asia was Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And some of these stans were part of the former Soviet Union. First and foremost was the breakup of the Soviet Union. And the next step was how to occupy, how to control, how to have hegemony in this area. And that, as you see in the Oil and Gas Journal, gives you the context, the absolute context for this world reach. In Congress itself in the early 1990s, there were congressional hearings, H.R. 2867. That was the House version of what's called the Silk Road Strategy Act for a Eurasian energy transport corridor, a pipeline south from Central Asia to the Indian Ocean. This pipeline has to go through Afghanistan. Now you can see clearly, if you follow the plans, the capitalist plans for control of the world's resources, you can predict where their wars are going to take place. 1990s, they're telling you they have to have control of Afghanistan. It may take them some time, just as Robert Tucker, writing in the 1970s, you go from one administration to another. Remember, we're talking about from Carter all the way through Clinton and beyond. It doesn't matter, Democratic or Republican administration. It's the same discretion.
Thanks, Maya. Thanks so much, brothers and sisters, for coming out this evening. It's really, for us, a great and continuous gratification to be in interaction with activists, people who are concerned about how we confront the realities of the criminalization of state power in our society. We are going to address tonight the apparatus of repression in relation to its most recent pretext for our ruling class, namely the events of September 11th, which we, over a period of time, have characterized as treason at the top. Many of you, having been involved in looking at the nature of power in our society over a period of time, are familiar with other events in our more recent history that compare with those of September 11th. For example, the assassination of the head of state, John F. Kennedy, not to mention the systematic elimination of mass leaders such as Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, and the virtual army of activists associated with black struggle, even the material witnesses to the crimes of our rulers who have been part of the litany of the dead and the removed at the hands of those who maintain power in our society. And as we often attempt to demonstrate and to describe, it's a hugely concentrated power apparatus that has hegemony in our country. 1% owns more than 95% of the rest of us combined. The actual number of people who make decisions about economic, political, and military affairs in our society, notwithstanding those who are the public relations intermediaries for this, is extraordinarily small. the former chairman of Avis and American Express, as I like so often to quote, Robert Townsend, calculated that 5,000 people control what he called the commanding heights of the U.S. economy. They averaged 14 corporate directorships per individual. And in his inimitable description, he stated, they look upon this country as their own private whorehouse and each president as their personal towel boy. That is not hyperbole. That is the character of power concentrated in the hands of corporate and finance capital in our society. The governance, the state, is a facade. Decisions are not made through the formal institutions. When Marxists and socialists speak about bourgeois democracy, it's not that they are in any way impugning democratic determination of decisions, but they're describing a structure in which form occurs, but without substance. The nominal institutions that are the arenas in which decisions are to be made are just facades, because power is concentrated elsewhere, and the state is but the coercive instrument of those who have monopolized this apparatus of power. And I do this because when we look at such things as the events of September 11th, 2001, notably because that criminal activity on the part of those in power is the little continuation of how they have always governed in our society. Every major undertaking, whether it's the expansion west and the extermination of the indigenous inhabitants, or that which followed from this, hegemony over markets on a global scale, it always has proceeded on the basis of pretexts, of rationalizations for long-prepared decisions. 9/11 emerges out of that. There has to be an ideological rationale for decisions and for policy making on the part of an illicit handful of people who rule without mediating that rule through approval on the part of those who are affected by it. And that ideological rationale for their politics and their policies takes various forms. The danger of subversion, in which any opposition is impugned as illicit. They are agents of a foreign power. They are demonic others. They are communists. They are this, they are that, they are whatever. And every war of predation is based upon a defensive response to this presumptive challenge to their power, which they identify with the national interest. 9/11 is no different. Except that we have now a new rationale to replace that which had been developed over a period of 70 and 80 years, virtually since the Bolshevik Revolution. With the decomposition of the Soviet Union, that was the category of terror. Something put in place and prepared since the mid-70s. Every major spokesperson for capital involved in its unfolding, every administration since 1964 already anticipating this. The Zionist state is but the local legatee of imperial policy, preparing the category of terror as the rationale for these undertakings. Look. We know, for example, with respect, to come back for a moment to the execution of John F. Kennedy, that the Mannlicher Carcano 6.5mm rifle had no ammunition live made for it after 1945, that it was a bolt-action rifle, no automatic trajectory, no fixed sight, physically incapable of expending the number of shots that were fired at the President of the United States. Wherever you look at the physical evidence that pertained to these events, and that's certainly true of September 11th, the laws of physics have to be altered to accommodate the official fiction with respect to these events. They don't stand the most elementary scrutiny, as so many have done so well in demonstrating and documenting. Hydrocarbon fires cannot reach a degree such as to compromise steel and reduce enforced concrete to pulverized powder, unless the laws of physics were reversed. The massive evidence that pertains to the collapse of those towers is, of course, elementary in understanding these events. Not to mention the fact that the people who are accused of having hijacked airplanes are people trained on Cessnas and Piper Cubs who have no remote capacity to handle airplanes of that character, beyond which the maneuvers undertaken by those aircraft, as has been so meticulously shown, are not compatible with pilot control. But when we have looked at these events over the years, many of us, what we've attempted to emphasize is this. The underlying politics of these events are what illuminate them for our understanding. We have to tie these events not merely to the physical evidence, which is, I don't in any way demean the importance of demonstrating the physical incompatibility of the evidence that pertains to these events and the official fiction, but to illuminate these undertakings, these events for our masses, for our population, for ourselves, we need to see the hand of governance and intelligence in their unfolding. Every single person associated with these events has a connection to U.S. intelligence. The putative hijackers are people trained at U.S. military installations. The hands of intelligence and governance are all over them. And consequently, the category of terror, which becomes the demonic rationale for the wars of predation that flow from all this, could not be put into motion without, as so many people have cited, the catastrophic event analogous to Pearl Harbor to provide the basis for policies in every administration's playbook since the early 60s. Every single one of these administrations pursuing these policies and requiring a catalytic event of this nature. It's not only Condoleezza Rice, it's not only Zbigniew Brzezinski who have articulated this. You'll find that Lawrence Mosher in 1975 is talking about the need to provide a pretext for seizing Arab oil for the 100,000-man quick strike force. We will have to find, he said, a boogeyman that is brought in order to sell this idea, this plan, this operation. And he may not translate the same in Arabic as he does in English. There's no ambiguity here.
I'm going to say a few things about the subject of domestic operations. I want to talk a bit about that, and then we'll talk some about martial law, and then maybe what it is that we might do in the event of martial law scenario. I mean, we could simplify that whole martial law thing by suggesting that 9/11 created the rationale for them to move towards this kind of declaration. But re-envisioning that, we might also suggest that the reason for martial law is because of the emergence of 9/11 truth. That the elephant in the room of 9/11 truth is what's, in a sense, responsible for the ratcheting up of this suppression and repression and even the attempt to penalize thought. I don't know how many of you have picked up on some H.R. 1955. The Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007. This is a thought crime legislation here. You ought to check this out. H.R. 1955, the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act, which includes the creation of a Center of Excellence for the Study of Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism in the United States. If it wasn't so serious, it would be a real joke. But in fact, it's real and has, I guess, somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 signers on. I mean, this is like everybody and their brother, including all the good liberals, have signed on to this. This is extremely dangerous and interesting and all those other things. So I suggest that you take a look at that. It's just out, October 24, 2007, H.R. 1955. People ask me, well, how did you get involved in the area of domestic operations of the Pentagon? And actually, I was working in a church in the South Bronx back in the late 70s, at about the time when the so-called homeless crisis was taking hold. And as a result of that and all the abandonment in the South Bronx, some of you remember the South Bronx was touted as kind of a symbol, you know, the poorest of the poor and these areas of vast stretches of abandonment and vacant lots and bombed out areas. Well, it wasn't clear to me then, but it became clear to me that the phrase bombed out was more meaningful than at first glance, that there were certain aspects of militarism involved even in that particular context. And this is what I mean, is that I began to do some research on the roots of displacement. In other words, how is it that the South Bronx came to be this bombed out area? And wasn't it interesting that similar processes were happening all over the country? Of course, the left often suggested a purely economistic argument that, well, capitalism is not interested in providing housing for poor people, therefore all of this was going on. Nonetheless, I looked into it a little further and had the good fortune of meeting some people in Washington, D.C., connected to the Black United Front, in particular some friends of a woman by the name of Yolanda Ward. Yolanda was Howard University student, 22 years old, African-American woman who, as a member of the Grassroots Unity Conference in Washington, D.C. in 1980, issued a paper which talked about this phenomenon of spatial deconcentration. Long story short, what the analysis pointed to was a process which included a collusion between HUD, Housing and Urban Development, and the Pentagon towards the forced removal of poor people from the urban centers, particularly those troublesome poor who were seen as the object of a counterinsurgency effort, which was derived from the workings of the Kerner Commission. Yolanda was assassinated in 1980. She remains an unsung hero to those of us who recognize the emergence of homelessness as an act of state repression, rather than the moral depravity of poor people, a result of the moral depravity of poor people, or the invisible hand of the capitalist economy not providing housing for poor people, but as an aspect of social control. So looking at the Kerner Commission report on civil disorder in 1968, the federal government, as a result, in part, President Johnson, as a result of occurrence of riots, so-called riots in 100-plus cities, 1967 into 68, created the Kerner Commission, or the Federal Commission to Study Civil Disorder. And President Johnson's mandate at that point, stated in an executive order, was to not only analyze the origins of these so-called riots, but to figure out ways, to pinpoint ways to prevent riots in the future. The commission issued its report. Chapter 17 of this civil disorder report, which was dealing with issues of civil disorder, from it's the euphemism that the government was using. Chapter 17 dealt with housing, civil disorder. Authored by Anthony Downs, a very interesting character, which Yolanda had pointed to in her analysis, which I had received a copy of. But with a long history of kind of murky intelligence background, Anthony Downs wrote Chapter 17 of the Kerner Commission report, which dealt with housing. It advocated a process of dispersal of the urban centers of the poor. Subsequent euphemisms for a similar process, planned shrinkage, was a term that later came into being. And these kinds of euphemisms did not arise spontaneously, but were part of a conscious effort on the part of the elite to undermine the stability, to disenfranchise, disempower, immobilize, disperse the troublesome poor from the urban centers. And secondarily, to reconcentrate those dispersed poor within low-intensity detention apparatus around the country, better known as shelters. 1979, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, was formed in Washington, D.C. This is 1979, the same year that the Coalition for the Homeless was formed in Washington, D.C., the National Coalition for the Homeless. In New York City, the Coalition for the Homeless sued the municipality around the question of a right to shelter. although within the New York State Constitution there is a stated right to a home, which is separate and distinct from a right to a shelter. Winning that suit created the legislative possibility and reality of barrack-style shelters in New York, which heretofore, to that point, were illegal. You couldn't stuff people in barracks, which had twice the incidence of AIDS and TB prior to that suit. This allowed for the warehousing of human beings, now classified as homeless. We would often refer to them as displaced tenants, who were overwhelmingly poor, black, and Latino people, and the consequence of a counterinsurgency strategy hatched during the Kerner Commission, during the machinations of the Kerner Commission, as a way to create the destabilization of populations that were deemed dangerous. You remember the Young Lords, the Black Panthers, and so forth and so on. This was an attack at the base.
You've been listening to three brief excerpts from 9/11, Permanent War, and the Repressive Apparatus of the State. Is Martial Law on the Agenda? This is an almost three-hour program with presentations by Maya Schoen, Ralph Schoenman, and Frank Morales, and a long discussion period of almost an hour. It is available to you, three CD, audio CD, for your contribution to WBAI of $100. Better spent $100, I can't think of. That's 212-209-2950. 9/11, Permanent War, and the Repressive Apparatus of the State is Martial Law on the Agenda. We'll be playing only brief excerpts for you in the coming weeks. The way to be present at this incredible lecture with Frank Morales, two-time winner of Sonoma State's University's Project Censored Award for Journalism, and Ralph and myself of WBAI's Taking Aim Radio, now in our seventh year broadcasting, thanks to all of you, our devoted listeners, 212-209-2950. 9/11, Permanent War, and the Repressive Apparatus of the State is Martial Law on the Agenda. Get those phones ringing. Ralph?
Well, Maya, I think it's important for our listeners, brothers and sisters, to be conscious of the fact that this question of martial law and this issue of a preemptive, or rather I should say a terrorist strike upon on the United States has been invoked continuously and very dramatically in the Democratic presidential debates. On the debate that took place prior to the New Hampshire primary, ABC News anchor Charles Gibson said the following, and this was his primary question to the candidates at the time. The central question on my mind is that of nuclear terrorism. The next president of the United States will have to deal with a nuclear attack on an American city. And I've been reading a lot about this in recent days. The best nuclear experts in the world state there's at least a 30% chance. Some estimates are higher. Graham Allison at Harvard states it's over 50%. Senator Sam Nunn, who knows a lot about this, posed two questions, and they stick in my mind, says Charles Gibson to Obama, to Clinton, to Edwards, to the others. On the day after the nuclear weapon goes off in an American city, what would we wish we had done to prevent it, and what are you going to do on the day after? Now, brothers and sisters, the so-called probability estimates that Charles Gibson was putting forward have zero scientific credibility, no basis in fact whatsoever. They are entirely based upon propaganda supplied by the U.S. military intelligence apparatus, who have a professional interest in terrorizing the people of the United States by constantly posing the imminent prospect of nuclear annihilation in order to intimidate everybody, but much more serious than that, to prepare for the military to control our society. And in fact, brothers and sisters, the response of all the major candidates reinforced Gibson's premise. John Edwards, in the short term, we are faced with a very, very, very serious threat that these nuclear weapons in the hands of terrorists who want to attack in the United States will result in such an attack. And it is the responsibility of the President of the United States to take steps to stop them. Barack Obama, the same leitmotif. It is the most significant policy issue that we confront, he said. And this is an extraordinary statement coming out of Barack Obama. And then, of course, Hillary Clinton echoing the same. We are going to demonstrate that those are responsible for planning this attack on our country are going to be targeted, retaliated against, she says. We are going to make it clear that there is no state safe haven for these stateless terrorists. They will face immediate and very heavy retaliation from my administration.
Ralph, I'd like to point out that in this premium, this 3CD premium, 9/11 permanent war and the repressive apparatus of the state is martial law on the agenda, we discuss specifically the apparatus historically and in the present of how they intend to impose martial law, what it means, and also we have a lengthy discussion during this evening of what to do about it, how we as the people of the United States can resist. And this is an amazing discussion that took place during this event. So please call 212-209-2950. It's at the time of the WBAI fund drive that we present to our listeners these events that you cannot be in if you're not in the Bay Area where we're having them, or if you're sometimes in New York where there are other special events. But these are not our regular programs. These are very special events, and part of these events are these to and fro discussion periods, and this was a really lively group. As I said, during the discussion and during Frank's presentation in particular, there is a discussion of what to do about it, how we can resist martial law should it be imposed. 212-209-2950. This is a topic we've been talking about for years. And you can see with the abrogation of civil liberties and the development of military plans with NORTHCOM how they intend to affect martial law in the United States. Ralph.
We discussed and we document in this series of talks that you will be getting on this CD, brothers and sisters, that the Bush administration established a shadow government consisting of 150 officials of the executive branch dispatched to secure fortified locations to provide continuity of government. And the Washington Post confirmed that, and they confirmed it on March 3rd, 2002, that the steps had already been taken by the Bush administration prior to 9/11 to implement what were called long-standing contingency plans, that the 100 officials would be were evacuated, and they were, in fact, evacuated by helicopter within hours of the World Trade Center attacks. They were taken to two locations in mountainous terrain believed to be in the eastern United States, which would be the seat of a temporary government. In fact, officials were drawn from top levels of the executive. What's interesting about that is that these were all officials from the military apparatus and from the executive. And according to the Washington Post on March 3rd, the Bush administration deployed the Delta Force within the United States. The same elite commando unit which had spearheaded the war in Afghanistan was already on alert in the United States, in Washington, at the time that 9/11 was going down. The most sinister aspect of that secret government was that it consisted entirely of executive branch officials. No pretense of any separation of branches of power. No pretense of following anything remotely like the U.S. Constitution. No pretense about there being a congressional or legislative or judicial branch of government. What we saw here, in effect, was the apparatus of a military dictatorship being already implemented and the actual officials evacuated to bunkers deep under the ground.
Ralph, I chose the excerpt where Frank speaks about spatial decomposition.
Deconcentration.
Spatial deconcentration. Because in addressing the issue of the homeless and how the people without means, most of the people in the United States, are funneled into what could be considered ghettos, and some places are actually ghettos, how this happens and how the perception of the poor is structured in the United States. United States is very important because this leads to the path, as Frank is discussing, of martial law. How we look at people, how we address the needs of the people is very important for the rulers to control. It is the ideology. It is how we view and how we think. And that is why WBAI is so important. Not only programs like Taking Aim, but programs that address the issues of prisoners, the issues of housing, that address issues of so many of us in the United States and in the greater New York area in particular. WBAI is a tremendous resource. 212-209-2950. Please flood the phones. Get on the phone now. 212-209-2950. It is your contribution, the contributions of each and every one of us that enable us each week to be with you on Taking Aim.
Well, Maya, the plans of 2001 and then the plans of 2002 were amplified in 2005. And we discussed this in this talk in Berkeley. I'm going to mention some of the particulars now. On August 8, 2005, the Washington Post published the following report. The Pentagon has developed its first ever war plans for operations within the continental United States, in which terror attacks will be used as a justification for imposing martial law on cities, regions, and the entire country. This front-page article, brothers and sisters, cites the sources that are working at the headquarters of the military's Northern Command in Colorado Springs. The plans themselves were classified, but, quote, the officers who drafted the plans gave details to Post reporter Bradley Graham, who was given a tour of the NORTHCOM headquarters at Peterson Air Force Base. A total of 15 crisis scenarios are outlined, brothers and sisters. And Graham describes the high-end plans, three simultaneous catastrophic mass casualty events for which they are preparing and utilizing as a pretext. The military will deploy a quick reaction force of 3,000 troops, 9,000 in total. The Post article quotes a statement by Admiral Timothy J. Keating, the head of NORTHCOM, that they are anticipating a biological and chemical and nuclear attack in any of the 50 states, that they are prepared to take the lead. The document of over 1,000 pages, which is designated as CONPLAN 202, goes through the general air, sea, and land operations inside the United States. CONPLAN 0500 specifies 15 detailed scenarios. This is not just idle chatter, brothers and sisters. We have laid it out. This CD gives you chapter and verse, blow by blow, of the preparation for martial law, the very operation that Charles Gibson was essentially fronting for in his setup question to the presidential candidates. And I just want to mention one further thing. The Attorney General of the United States, Michael Mukasey, the same Michael Mukasey who had written in the Wall Street Journal that he favors what he calls a parallel judicial system in which those who are guilty of threatening national security will be treated as our mental patients, not entitled to trial, not entitled to lawyers, not entitled to a judicial process, but to be put away and committed like the mentally ill. This same Michael Mukasey has just declared that he anticipates that there's going to be a terror attack on the United States to disrupt the national elections in 2008. Got the picture? You want the information, you want the data, you want the discussion of what is to be done and how we go about mobilizing the resistance, because let's not have any blinkers on here, brothers and sisters. This is a ruthless, relentless ruling class in an economic crisis of mammoth proportions, terrified of our population. Get the CDs, brothers and sisters. We have to arm ourselves politically for the struggles ahead.
This is a three-CD set. 9/11, Permanent War, and the Repressive Apparatus of the State is martial law on the agenda. Frank Morales, two-time winner of Sonoma State University's Project Censored Award and one of the leaders of New York 9/11 Truth, Ralph Schoenman, and myself. This took place in Berkeley, California, on October 30th, 2007. We know you're going to want to listen to this, and that's why we've edited it and prepared it and packaged it for this 3-CD set. It's an amazing discussion. 212-209-2950. We're here in California, and it's a little difficult to hear the phones ringing. Please get them ringing loud and clear. 212-209-2950. Don't wait for the last minute. Be the first on your block. These are ready to ship out. 212-209-2950. 9/11, permanent war, and the repressive apparatus of the state. Posing the real question before each and every one of us today, is martial law on the agenda and what we can do about it?
Maya, the article that I cite in this talk that appeared in the Washington Post on August 8th of 2005 tells us the following. The NORTHCOM, with its headquarters staff of 640, is already larger than the Southern Command, which oversees U.S. military operations throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. 1,400 National Guard units have been organized into a dozen response units. Quick reaction forces have been set up in each of the 50 states. The Pentagon, this is the Washington Post, acutely conscious of the potential political backlash as its role in these security operations becomes known, has designated the following. Military exercises in the United States, codenamed Vital Archer, involving troops in lead roles, are shrouded in secrecy. Other exercises involving troops in supporting roles are widely publicized, but the security operations, codenamed Vital Archer, are shrouded in secrecy as they already are put into place. That's 2005, August 8th, in the Washington Post.
And, Ralph, what we don't want as a secret is support for Taking AIM and WBAI, and I'm pleased to hear the phones ringing. We're on only until 6 when the news comes on, and then there's the National Pacifica coverage of Super Tuesday. These elections, this sham presentation that there's a choice to be made among the ruling class of this country, that they would serve any one of our interests, this is a sham. And it's here on Taking AIM that we discuss these issues each and every week. We discuss the real analysis, the truth, and what we can do about it. And that's why this event was so amazing. Nobody wanted to go home. Absolutely no one wanted to go home. It was at the Unitarian Church, and they kept it open late. The people who worked for the church were there, and they were as startled and engaged in this discussion as each and every one of the other people who were there. And so this went on long into the evening. 9/11, permanent war, and the repressive apparatus of the state is martial law on the agenda, a topic that really hits home with each and every one of us, something that we need to discuss more and more, particularly what we are going to do when this is imposed. As you can see, with all the steps that are taking place in the Congress, and as well with all the executive decrees, and what goes on behind in the military, this is the topic of the day. 212-209-2950. And it is especially a topic today on Super Tuesday. You have only a few more minutes. Please get on the phone. 212-209-2950. If the phones are busy, keep dialing. 212-209-2950. Ralph?
January 31st, 2008, brothers and sisters, Associated Press. The military not ready for pending attack on U.S. The United States military is not ready for the catastrophic attack on the country. The National Guard units don't have sufficient equipment to do the job they need to do. They've set up a commission charged by Congress to prepare for the equipment and the funding necessary for the units that will be put into play within the United States. This is January 31st. They're already sounding the alarm, making the preparations, and telling us that they don't have enough money. They have trillions of dollars, but not enough money for what they plan to do to establish martial law.
Well, Ralph,
this
is clear in the budget that President Bush proposed before Congress. This is the recent budget, $3.1 trillion budget, that not only makes permanent the tax cuts, that is the shifting of funds to the wealthy, the few wealthy, but also the specific words of President Bush that the budget would freeze all non-defense spending. That means not defense, all military spending, non-military spending would be frozen, eliminate or sharply cut back 151 essential social service programs. This includes Medicare, Medicaid, reduced by $23 billion in 2009 and over $474 billion over the next 5 years. You know what the consequences of this? This means death, devastation to people in the United States.
Maya, the report on January 31st quotes Air Force General Gene Renoir, Chief of the United States Northern Command, quote, "The Pentagon is putting together specialized military teams designed to respond to the catastrophic event. The capability for the Defense Department to respond to the pending chemical or biological event exists now." And he's asking for emergency funds to amplify this, what he calls the third wave, with 4,000 troops and Air Force units and engineers and support forces put into place. Funaro is a retired Marine Corps Major General. And that declaration by Punaro makes very clear that they are not just treating this as an idle prospect, but they are preparing for its imminent implementation.
And that's why, Ralph, the issue of how the tax money is spent is critical. Here in California, California, which is the seventh largest economy in the world, not just as a state, but in the world, here in California, again, healthcare slashed, education slashed, public sector workers to be unemployed, to reduce the public sector here in California. Why? Diversion of funds nationally for this war machine, for this imperial hegemony, as we played excerpts from the presentation today and the discussion.
And brothers and sisters, in today, February 5th, issue of Salon, Glenn Greenwald states the following. In August, when the Bush administration wanted to pressure Congress into passing the Protect America Act, which vested vast powers in the president for eavesdropping and spying on Americans, they sent out Mike McConnell days before the recess to tell everyone in Congress that they better pass the bill because the terrorists are about to attack us and the blood will be on their hands. Now this article in Salon amplifies the August events. Congressional administration and intelligence officials last week have described events leading up to surveillance and a remarkable series of confrontations capitalizing on fresh reports of a pending and growing terrorism threat. Now, what we're looking at here, as we quote the Salon article of today's date, is the breathless and rapid preparation for precisely the scenario of military rule in the United States, which is what we set forth, what we lay out, and where we begin to get the discussion going on what it is that we need to do to organize the resistance. How is it going to happen? Who is going to take responsibility for it? How do we coordinate working people, organized efforts on the part of the anti-war movement to fight back, to resist, to take on this ruling class with its pending plans for military rule, for martial law, for mass detention centers, for the apparatus of the fascist state?
We have only two more minutes in this session of Taking Aim, and it is a session. It is a session, an event, each week that is brought to you by you, the listeners, the supporters of WBAI. We would not be speaking to you. We would not be reaching out into 77 countries without WBAI, which enables the production of Taking Aim. 212-209-2950, the important WBAI internet site, www.wbai.org, which allows the streaming of the shows, the archive, the important website, and most of all, the radio station itself. 212-209-2950. There are only a couple of minutes left. Please get on the phone and 9/11 permanent war and repressive apparatus of the state is martial law, and the agenda will be in your home soon.
And one more point to make, brothers and sisters. In today's Telegraph, Daily Telegraph in London, they establish that, quote, a British document shows that Israel initiated the Entebbe attack. Quote, the State of Israel was behind the hijacking of the Air France plane to Entebbe in 1976. It was, in fact, an Israeli intelligence affair. They had sent provocateur into the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. They seized the plane. Now, this has been the signal event of so-called terrorists, Palestinian terrorists, who hijacked the plane to Entebbe. What do we learn today, brothers and sisters, in the Daily Telegraph and in Yedioth Ahronot, the Israeli publication? It was a false flag operation. It was an Israeli intelligence operation to create the basis for mass repression against the Palestinian population in the West Bank and Gaza. That is the actual model for 9/11. That's what we're facing. That's what we're resisting. That's what this CD is all about, brothers and sisters.
The three CDs, Ralph. Three lectures. Maya Schoen, Ralph Schoenman, Ralph with over a 40-minute lecture. Oh, actually, it's an hour lecture. Ralph and Frank Morales with a 40-minute lecture and an hour discussion. 9/11 permanent war and the repressive apparatus of the state is martial law and the agenda. Your contribution of $100 to WBAI 212-209-2950. Keep the calls coming. And now to Michael and then to the news.
Well, thank you so much, Ralph and Maya. We really appreciate your efforts this afternoon. So many people are calling in. We want to let people know that if you're not getting picked up right away, please be patient. We have a shortage of volunteers right now.